Immediately, we began our dance again, with me trying to pull him closer, him keeping me at arm's length. I asked, "When did he die?" Then it came out, "My son died as an infant." I felt the heat of a big adrenaline rush. The explanation was obvious. Eric Hines was a stolen identity. Somehow I managed to pull myself together enough to babble something about being sorry for his loss. So who was he really, this one-legged bullshit artist who was working with the FBI and using a phony name? Meanwhile, I felt the need to satisfy myself that what Eric Hines Sr. had told me about his son dying in infancy was really true. Again, with the help of my pal, Ann, at the Social Security Administration, I tracked down Eric Sr.'s brother, who confirmed the story. Eric Jr. had died in a car accident in 1962 at the age of 2, on his way to the Seattle World's Fair with his mother, who was also killed in the crash. No wonder Eric Sr. had turned so cold when I claimed his son and I had gone to high school together. There is a particular kind of satisfaction in following a thread all the way to its end. In this case, that meant getting a copy of Eric Hines' death record from the King County Bureau of Vital Statistics in Seattle. I sent a request, enclosing the nominal fee required, and asked that it be mailed to me at Teltech. The father and the uncle had been telling me the truth. The Eric Hines I knew was playing a familiar game of infant identity theft. Wow, I had finally cracked open the truth about him. The name Eric Hines was a complete phony. So then who the fuck was this guy who was dead but trying to set me up? Going back over my traffic analysis of FBI cell phone calls, I noticed that McGuire was making a lot of calls to 213-894-0336. I already knew that 213-894 was the area code in exchange for the phones at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. I called the number and found it was the phone for one David Schindler, the assistant U.S. attorney who had been the prosecutor on the Polson case. He'd be just the guy, I thought, who would get assigned to take on the next big Los Angeles hacker case. So the government apparently already had a prosecutor assigned to me. Not good. From the time I first gained access to Pactel Cellular's call detail records, showing an almost up-to-the-minute log of calls both to and from every one of the company's subscribers, I'd been checking them often, targeting the people on the white-collar crime unit who were frequently in touch with Eric, focusing in particular on Special Agent McGuire. That was how I happened to spot an attention-getting series of calls over a span of a few minutes. McGuire had called Eric's pager several times, and McGuire's very next call after his last attempt was to a landline number I hadn't seen before. I called the number. Well, hello, I knew that voice well. The person who answered the phone was Eric, at a new landline number in a different part of Los Angeles. He had moved again. Hanging up, I had a smile on my face. Eric would know a hang-up had to be me. Probably before he had finished unpacking, I had already found out he had moved. Pac-Bell's Line Assignment Center would be the place to get Eric's new address. It was 2270 Laurel Canyon Boulevard, which turned out to be in a pricey neighborhood about a mile north of Hollywood Boulevard in the Hollywood Hills, halfway up toward Mulholland Drive. His fourth address in the several months I had known him. The reason wasn't hard to figure. The Bureau was trying to protect him. Each time I found his new address, the feds would move him. I had now found his address three times, and they had moved him each time. You would think they might have figured out by then that his location was a secret they were not going to be able to keep from me. In front of a computer in a safe location, hacking by night, in front of a computer, investigating for Teltech by day. The Teltech work mostly involved projects like figuring out where the husband in a divorce case was hiding his assets, helping an attorney decide whether or not to file a lawsuit by finding out whether the potential defendant had enough of a bankroll to make it worthwhile, and tracking down deadbeats. A few cases were gratifying, like locating a parent who had abducted his or her own child and fled to Canada, Europe, or wherever. The satisfaction I got from succeeding in those cases was enormous and left me feeling I was doing a small bit of good in the world. But doing good deeds for society wasn't going to earn me any brownie points with law enforcement. I figured out how to set up an early warning system to sound the alarm if the feds were hanging around waiting to follow me when I left work. I bought a Radio Shack scanner that had the cellular band unblocked. The FCC had started cracking down on scanner manufacturers to prevent the interception of cell phone traffic. I also bought a device called a Digital Data Interpreter, or DDI, a special box that could decode the signaling information on the cellular network. The scanner signals fed into the DDI, which was connected to my computer. The cell phone registers with the nearest cell tower and establishes communications with it so that when a call comes in for you, the system knows which cell tower to relay the call to on its way to your handset. Without this arrangement, the cell phone company would have no way of getting a call routed to you. I programmed the scanner to monitor the frequency of the cell tower nearest to Teltech, so it would pick up information from the tower identifying the phone number of every cell phone in or even just passing through the area. My scanner fed this constant flow of data to the DDI, which converted the information into separate pieces, like this. 618-1000, 213, registration. 610-2902, 714, paging. 400-8172, 818, paging. 701-1223, 310, registration. Each line shows the status of a cell phone currently in the area served by this cell site. The first set of digits on the line is the phone number of one cell phone. Paging signifies that the site is receiving a call for that cell phone and is signaling the phone to establish a connection. Registration indicates that the phone is in the area of this cell tower and ready to make or receive calls. I configured the DDI software package on my computer to play an alarm tone if the DDI detected any phone number that I programmed into the software. The cell phone numbers of all the FBI agents I had identified as being in communication with Eric. The software continually scanned the phone numbers being fed to it in the chain of cell site, to scanner, to DDI, to computer. If any of the agent's cell phones showed up in the Teltech area, my setup would sound the alert. I had created a trap for the FBI, putting me one step ahead. If the feds came looking for me, I'd be forewarned. 23. Raided. On a Monday in late September 1992, I arrived at work early before anyone else was in. As I walked down the hall, I started hearing a faint beep, beep, beep. I thought I must have incorrectly entered the alarm code for getting into the Teltech offices, but the farther I went down the hall, the louder the beeping became. Beep, 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 beep. The sound was coming from my office. Maybe somebody had stashed an electronic alarm of some sort at my desk? No. It was something else. My early warning system. The beeping had been triggered by the software package monitoring my scanner. The scanner was picking up an FBI cell phone in the area. Shit, 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 shit. The computer showed me the phone number of the cell phone that had triggered the alarm. 213-500-6418. Ken McGuire's cell phone. The DDI software on my computer showed that the alarm had been triggered at 6:36 a.m., a couple of hours earlier. McGuire had been in the area, somewhere near Teltech. My computer was also showing the digits McGuire had dialed, 818-8809-XXX. Back in those days in Los Angeles, the 9 in that position of the phone number usually meant a payphone. McGuire was calling a payphone in my neighborhood. Moments later, it hit me, and it confirmed my worst fear. McGuire had called the payphone near the Village Market, the convenience store directly across the street from my apartment. That was only a couple of miles away from Teltech, barely more than a 5-minute drive. 1,000 things were running through my mind. Why were they here? They were setting up to follow me. Or they followed me here to arrest me. Should I run? Hide? Sit and wait for them to come bursting through the door? I was startled, scared, terrified. Wait a minute. If they had come to arrest me, they would have knocked on my door while I was still in the apartment. Why would McGuire call the village market? Suddenly the answer came clear. To get a search warrant. They would need a description of my apartment complex and the exact location of my unit. Maybe McGuire wasn't ready to arrest me yet. He was just getting the location details that he needed to put into the search warrant before presenting it to a judge. Michael and Mark both arrived at work. I updated them. Ken McGuire's been to my apartment this morning, while I was still asleep. Their expressions were priceless. How the hell does he always find out these things? All along they had been fascinated by my stories about how I was penetrating the entire FBI operation against me. They had been eating it up, and this was the capper. I gathered up all my personal belongings and headed down the stairs to my car, freaked out and uncomfortable, afraid at any moment I'd hear someone shout, "Mitnick, freeze!" In the parking area, I peered intently into every car to see if there were any guys in suits keeping watch for me. As I cautiously pulled out of the garage, my eyes were all but glued to the rearview mirror. I was concentrating more on what might be behind me than what was in front. I jumped onto the 101 freeway and gunned it to Agoura Hills, one city over, far enough away that I would be comfortable using my cell phone. Rolling off the freeway, I pulled into a McDonald's parking lot. My first call was, naturally, to Lewis. "The feds are coming," I told him. Most everything washed off, Lewis. The shell of arrogance was usually impenetrable. Not this time. I could hear the news had made him uncomfortable, nervous. If the feds were targeting me, they had to know he'd been involved in my hacking. It was almost a dead certainty that they wouldn't want just Mitnick. I went back to my apartment and went through it thoroughly, inch by inch, rounding up everything I had accumulated since the last cleanup that might help make a case against me. Papers, disks, scraps of anything with writing on it, and the same with my car. That evening I knocked on Mark Kasdan's door and asked if I could store the stuff in his closet along with the earlier stash I had left with him. I returned to my apartment and moved my computer back once more to my father's friend's place where I had hidden it once before. When I was finished, I was satisfied I was thoroughly clean. I booked into a small motel just down the street, afraid to stay in my own apartment. I didn't sleep very well and was awake early, tossing and turning. Tuesday morning I drove to work feeling like a character in a bad spy movie. Any helicopters? Crown Victorias? Suspicious-looking guys in suits and short haircuts? Nothing. I felt the other shoe could drop at any moment. But the day went by peacefully. I actually managed to get some work done. Driving home, I stopped by a donut shop and bought a dozen assorted. On the door of the fridge, I scotch-taped a note, "FBI Donuts." On the box, in large letters, I wrote, "FBI Donuts." I hoped they'd be really upset that I'd known not only that I was going to be raided, but exactly when. The next morning, September 30th, 1992, now back in my own apartment, I was sleeping fitfully, feeling nervous and jumpy, never quite entirely asleep. Around 6 o'clock a.m., I woke up, alarmed. Someone was jiggling a key in my apartment door. I was expecting the feds, but they don't use a key. They pound. Was this somebody trying to break in? I shouted, "Who's there?" hoping to scare the intruder away. "FBI, open up." I thought, this is it. I'm going back to jail. Even though I had known they were coming, I wasn't emotionally prepared. How could I be? I was petrified of getting arrested. I answered the door, not even realizing I was stark naked. At the front of the pack was a lady agent who couldn't keep herself from glancing down. Then a whole team stepped into view and pushed their way into the room. They shook down the place while I got dressed, even thoroughly inspecting the contents of the fridge. No one commented or cracked a smile at my FBI Donuts sign, and the entire dozen went untouched. But I had done a good cleanup job. They didn't find anything incriminating in the fridge, and they didn't find anything anywhere else that would help their case. Of course they didn't like that, and they didn't like my naive, playing dumb attitude. One agent sat down at the kitchen table and said, "Come over here. Let's talk." FBI agents are generally very polite, and this guy and I knew each other. He was Special Agent Richard Beasley, an agent who had been involved in my DEC case. He said in a friendly tone and with what sounded like a Texas drawl, "Kevin, this is your second time around. We're searching DePayne right now. He's cooperating. Unless you cooperate, you're going to be sitting on the back of the bus." I'd never heard the expression before, but the meaning was clear. The first guy to roll over on the other one gets a much better deal. Lewis and I had talked about this many times. "What would you do if the police questioned you?" one of us would ask the other. The answer was always, "Tell them to talk to my lawyer." I wasn't going to rat on him, and I knew he'd be a stand-up guy for me as well. Beasley pulled out a tape cassette. He asked me, "Do you have a cassette player?" "No." I couldn't figure this. The agency that likes to think it's the best law enforcement agency in the United States, if not the world, comes with a cassette tape they want me to listen to, but nobody thinks to bring along a player? One of the other agents spotted my large boombox and brought it over. Beasley put in the cassette and punched play. I heard a call being dialed, and Mark Kasdan talking in the background. Then my voice. It sounded like Mark and I were talking in the same room. I could hear the ringing sound after the digits were dialed. The next voice to spill out of the boombox said something like, "Welcome to Pacific Bell voicemail. Please enter your mailbox number." More digits being dialed. "Please enter your password. You have 3 new messages." And then, "Hi, Daryl, this is David Simon. Please call me at 818-783-42XX. Then another call, my voice again saying, "Hey, Detective Simon just called Santos." Beasley shut off the tape player. "What do you have to say?" he challenged. I'm afraid I sneered at him. It's amazing what the FBI can do with technology. I said it arrogantly, looking him straight in the eye. Another agent who'd been standing next to us throughout this exchange reached over, grabbed the boombox, and yanked the cassette door right off, like a 4-year-old having a temper tantrum. The agents fanned out to search. I sat at the table watching. Another agent arrived. He handed me his card, which said, "Supervisory Special Agent." He opened a large, loose-leaf notebook he had brought and started jotting notes. After a few moments, he looked up and asked, "Where's his computer?" "We didn't find one," he was told. He looked annoyed. They kept searching. Finally, I asked the agent in charge, "Am I under arrest?" "No," he said. "What? Not under arrest?" I couldn't believe it. That made no sense. But he wasn't toying with me. None of the other agents even flinched. It must be true. "Let's test this. If I'm not under arrest, I'm leaving," I said. "Where to?" the supervisory agent asked. "To my dad's, to ask him if I should cooperate." "Cooperate, yeah, sure. But whatever I needed to say so I could get out of there, to someplace I could feel comfortable." The agent thought about it for a moment. If I wasn't being arrested, what was the point of making me stay there, watching them ransack my apartment? "Okay," he said. They frisked me, found my wallet, and searched it. They found nothing interesting inside, and they let me walk out. 3 agents followed me to my car. After I unlocked it, they started to search. Shit! They found a box of floppies I had overlooked in the glove box. I was dismayed and worried. They were delighted. When they had finished searching my car, they opened the doors and got in, sitting there like we were best friends going on an outing together. I was shocked. I said, "What are you guys doing in my car?"
"We're going with you to your dad's."
"No, you're not. Get out of my car." And what do you know? They did. They got into 2 FBI cars and followed me for the drive to where my father was then living with a new girlfriend I didn't much like. When we got to my dad's house, they said they wanted to go in with me. I told them they couldn't, that I wanted to have a discussion with him alone. They didn't leave, just got back into their cars and sat while I went inside. I hadn't finished my cleanup at Teltech and needed to get back there without an FBI surveillance team. When I looked out, they were still sitting there. I went out and told them my dad and I had decided I was going to consult an attorney before speaking with them. I was trying to give them a glimmer of hope that I might cooperate, even though I had no intention of doing so. They finally left. As soon as they were out of sight, I hustled to my car and sped to Teltech. And why didn't I get to meet Agent Ken McGuire or Pacific Bell's Terry Atchley on that fateful day? They had gone to DePayne's, hoping to get him to flip on me, rat me out. Lewis offered to do exactly that. I've read the FBI report of the conversation. Lewis keeps offering to talk, but keeps asking for assurances, and he keeps saying that I'm dangerous, and he's afraid of me. So I hadn't been arrested, and I knew the agents wouldn't find anything incriminating in my apartment. My guess was that they were looking for something more serious than cavorting with Lewis to charge me with. At the time, I still didn't know that Teltec had been raided months earlier, so I had no reason to think the feds might be shaking down Kasdan's apartment at the same time they were searching mine. But that was exactly what they were doing, apparently having figured that my hacking might be tied in somehow with Teltec's illegal activities, accessing TRW with stolen merchant credentials and so on. So much for my bright idea that I could safely stash my disks and notes at Mark's. But time might be on my side. My supervised release from my conviction for hacking into DEC with Lenny DeCiccio was due to expire in less than 3 months. If the feds hadn't shown up with an arrest warrant by then, I would be scot-free. The computer I was using at Teltec didn't have any encryption tools on it, and I had to make sure the agents didn't get anything more on me. I pulled up at Teltec and dashed up the stairs. Fantastic. No team of federal agents at work. Unbelievable. I sat down at the computer in my office and gave the commands for erasing all data. In case you don't already know this, it's been in the news from time to time, perhaps most notably when White House staffer Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's cover-up attempt over the Iran-Contra affair got tripped up. Simply giving delete commands doesn't truly erase data from a computer's hard drive. Instead, it just changes the name of each file to simply mark it as having been deleted. Those items no longer show up in searches, but they're still stored on the drive, and they can be recovered. So instead of just giving delete commands, I used a program called Wipe Info, part of the Norton Utilities Suite. Wipe Info is designed not just to mark files as deleted, but to write over them several times so they can no longer be recovered. When the program was done, there was no way a single file of mine could have been recovered from that drive. I called my Teltec boss, Michael Grant, and told him about the raid. He wanted to know, "Where are you now?" "I'm at the office." "What are you doing?" "I'm wiping my computer clean." He was furious and tried to order me to stop. Incredible. I had thought we were a team. I had thought he and his father would be on my side. Instead, he was trying to talk me into leaving the evidence on my computer. It sounded like the Teltec bosses might be hoping to slime their way out of the trouble they were in by helping the feds build a case against me. In fact, one of my fellow employees at Teltec, another investigator who had become a buddy of mine, later confirmed that this was exactly what Michael Grant tried to do shortly after that, make a deal with the feds to go easy on him and his dad in exchange for their testifying against me. I was sad and disappointed when my suspicions were confirmed. I had thought Michael Grant was my friend. I never gave evidence against anyone, even though I could have made deals that would have greatly benefited me. I guess when your friends are people who are breaking the law, you're naive if you expect loyalty. A couple of days later, Michael Grant told me I was through at Teltec. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. 24. Vanishing Act. By November, I was still jobless, but making a little money doing stuff for Teltec's former employee, Danny Yellen, who had some outside assignments he was feeding to me. Things like finding people for car repossessions. I would track them through the public utilities and the welfare department. Meanwhile, I was sitting on a time bomb. The feds would be poring over all the stuff of mine they had picked up from Mark's apartment, plus whatever they had grabbed from Lewis's, and might find grounds for sending me back to jail. What should I do? Well, for the moment, I thought it would be comforting to be with my mom and Graham for Thanksgiving, so I called my probation officer, Frank Gulla, and asked for permission, half expecting to be turned down. Surprisingly, he granted the permission, so long as I returned by December 4th. I would later learn that back on November 6th, the probation department had written to the court asking for a bench warrant for my arrest, citing my accessing of a Pacific Bell security agent's voicemail and my associating with Lewis DePayne. The bench warrant was issued the next day, setting bail at $25,000. So why did Gulla give me permission to leave town instead of telling me I needed to come in and see him? I haven't figured that out to this day. When you're on federal parole, probation, or supervised release, you need to check in with the local probation department whenever you travel to a different federal district. The morning after I arrived in Las Vegas, I headed downtown to the Bonneville Avenue office to check in. Natural instinct told me I should make sure there wasn't anything going on that I would want to know about before I got there. I just had a gut feeling that something might be up. In the car, I had a ham radio that I'd modified so I could transmit and receive outside the frequency bands authorized for amateur radio operators. I tuned to one of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department's tactical frequencies. I listened for half an hour or so to pick up the protocol a cop would use when he wanted to ask if there was an outstanding warrant on the guy driving a car he had stopped. He'd say, "I need a 1028 on license plate blank." At the same time, I was taking mental note of the identifiers the cops used when calling dispatch. For example, 1 George 21. The dispatch operator would respond, "Go ahead, 1 George 21. What did they say when they were taking time for lunch or whatever? A call would come over the air that included phrases like, "Code 7, Denny's, Rancho Drive." I waited 10 minutes, then pressed the transmit key on my radio, used the same call sign as some cops who were at that moment enjoying lunch at Denny's, and said, "I need a 1028 on California license plate," and gave my own plate number. After a moment, the control operator said, "Are you clear, 440? My heart began racing. What did 440 mean? I had no idea. I radioed back, "Stand by." Using my cloned cell phone, I called the police in the nearby town of Henderson and said, "This is Special Agent Jim Casey, DEA. I'm in Las Vegas with the Multi-Agency Narcotics Task Force. I need to know what 440 means in Las Vegas." "That's a wanted person." "Oh, shit. So, are you clear 440 meant, are you standing away from the wanted person so I can tell you what he's wanted for?" The Las Vegas police were holding a warrant for me that cited my car's license tags. If I walked into the probation office, it was extremely likely I'd be put in handcuffs and sent back to prison. I felt great relief that I dodged that bullet, but I was washed with fear. I was just coming up on the entry to the Sahara Hotel. I swung in their parking lot, parked, and walked away from the car. The Sahara. It couldn't have been any more convenient. My mom happened to be working as a waitress in the coffee shop. I sauntered through the glitz and glitter of the casino, past the eager, quietly rowdy players throwing dice at the craps tables, and the hordes of silver-haired, dead-eyed women feeding the slot machines. I sat at a table until my mom's shift ended and she could drive me to her house. When I told her and my grandmother that I was very likely on my way back to prison, the family was thrown into turmoil. Thanksgiving is supposed to be a happy, festive occasion, but there was no happiness for us that year, no giving of thanks. Over the next few days, instead of going into the probation office, I made 2 after-hours phone calls there, leaving messages on the answering machine that I was reporting in by phone because my mom was sick and I couldn't leave her. Was my probation officer calling them about taking me into custody? I had recognized the synthesized voice on the outgoing message on the probation office answering machine, which clued me in about what type of answering machine they had. The manufacturer used 000 as the default code for retrieving messages. I tried, and yes, once again, nobody had bothered to change the default code. I called every couple of hours, listening to all the messages. Happily, there were none from my probation officer. My grandmother, my mother, and her boyfriend, Steve Niddle, drove me back to Los Angeles. I certainly wasn't going to be driving my own car. We arrived late on December 4th. The day my travel permit expired. I walked into my apartment with no way of knowing that U.S. Marshal Brian Salt had come by to arrest me early that morning. I stayed for the next 3 days, scared and anxious, expecting the FBI to show up at any minute, leaving very early every morning and going to a movie every night to distract myself. Maybe another guy would have been out drinking and partying all night, but my nerves were shot. I figured these might be my last days of freedom for a while. But I wasn't going to leave L.A. again until my supervised release ended. I had decided if they came for me, so be it. They could take me. But if they didn't come by the time my supervised release expired, I had decided on my future. I would become someone else and disappear. I would go live in some other city far away from California. Kevin Mitnick would be no more. I tried to think through my plans for going on the run. Where would I live while I set up a phony identity? What city should I pick as my new home? How would I earn a living? The idea of being far away from my mother and grandmother was devastating to me because I loved them so much. I hated the idea of putting them through any more pain. At the stroke of midnight on December 7th, 1992, my supervised release officially expired. No call from my probation officer, no early morning raid. What a relief. I was a free man. Or so I thought. My mother, grandmother, and Steve had been staying at my cousin Trudy's. We now switched places, my mother and Steve moving into my place to pack up all my things while I moved in with my grandmother at Trudy's. No point hanging around the apartment now that my supervised release was up. People who wear or carry badges sometimes work in mysterious ways. Early in the morning of December 10th, 3 days after my supervised release ended, my mother and Steve were at my apartment in the last stage of packing up my things and making arrangements for moving the furniture. A knock at the door. The minions of law enforcement had finally shown up, a trio of them this time. U.S. Marshal Brian Salt, an FBI agent whose name my mom didn't catch, and my nemesis, Agent Ken McGuire, whom I still had never seen or met in person. My mother brazenly told them that she and I had had an argument a few days earlier. I had left, she said, and she hadn't heard from me since and didn't know where I was. She added, "Kevin's probation is up." When Salt said he had a warrant for my arrest and had left a notice on my door for me to contact him, she told him the truth. He never saw any notice. He would have told me if he had. She then had a shouting match with the agents over whether or not my probation was up. Later, she told me she wasn't the least bit intimidated by them. In her opinion, they were acting like idiots, especially the one who opened the refrigerator and peered inside as if he thought I might be hiding in there. She just looked at the agent and laughed at him. Of course, he might have been checking to see if I had left any donuts again. They finally went away, empty-handed and with no information. As far as I was concerned, I was a free man, free to leave Los Angeles before any new charges were filed against me. But I knew I couldn't ride back to Las Vegas with my mother. That would be too dangerous. They might be watching her. So Graham offered to drive me back to Vegas after I finished up some business in L.A. One unfinished piece of business was still haunting me. I had conned the DMV into sending me a copy of Eric Hines's driver's license, but I'd used my safety precaution of having the first Kinko's forwarded to a second one, just in case law enforcement had caught on and was staking out the place waiting for me. Since what I picked up had been faxed twice, the image was so grainy that it hadn't been much help. I still wanted to get the driver's license photographs of Wernley, Ways, and Hines to see if any of them were the same person. On December 24th, Christmas Eve, just before starting to load my things into Graham's car, I called the DMV posing as Larry Curry, the name of a real investigator with the Los Angeles County Welfare Fraud Unit, giving that unit's requester code along with Curry's PIN, birth date, and driver's license number. I requested sound exes on Eric Hines, Joseph Wernley, and Joseph Ways. The technician who took my request had been alerted. She notified DMV Senior Special Investigator Ed Lovelace, who, according to an official report filed afterward, did a little checking and found that the fax number I provided belonged to a Kinko's in Studio City. Lovelace told the technician to make up a phony sound ex, and she prepared one with a picture of Annie Driver, a fictional character the agency used for instructional purposes. Then Lovelace contacted an investigator at the DMV office in Van Nuys and asked her to stake out the Kinko's location to identify and arrest the person who came in to pick up the facts. The investigator recruited some colleagues to accompany her, and the FBI was notified and agreed to send an agent of its own. All of this was going on when the only thing everybody really wanted was to be at home getting ready for Christmas Eve. A few hours after calling to request those sound exes from the DMV, with my things now packed into my grandmother's car, we ate lunch with Trudy. I said my goodbyes and told her how much I had appreciated being able to stay with her. She and I hadn't been in close contact, so the favor she'd done me seemed all the more special. As Graham and I set out, I told her I had a small errand to do that would take me only a minute. We headed for Kinko's. By now, the four DMV inspectors, dressed as usual in their civilian clothes, were getting impatient. They had been waiting for more than 2 hours already. The FBI agent detailed to join them had shown up, hung around for a while, and then taken off again. I directed my grandmother to the Kinko's in a strip mall at Laurel Canyon and Ventura in Studio City, so called because of the nearby Disney, Warner's, and Universal lots. I pointed out where I wanted her to park, in a handicapped space outside of a supermarket, a couple of 100 feet or so from the Kinko's. She hung her handicapped placard on the rearview mirror as I got out of the car. You might expect that Kinko's would be empty on Christmas Eve. Instead, it was as full of people as it would have been in the middle of a workday. I waited in line at the fax counter for something like 20 minutes, growing increasingly impatient. My poor grandmother was waiting for me, and I wanted nothing more than to pick up the Soundexes and get out of town. Finally, I just walked behind the counter myself, flipped through the envelopes of incoming faxes, and pulled out the one labeled with my alias, Larry Curry, which the DMV had misspelled. It was actually C-U-R-R-I-E, Los Angeles County Welfare Fraud. When I pulled the sheets out of the manila envelope, I was pissed off. Not what I'd asked for, just a picture of a nondescript lady. What the fuck? I knew DMV employees could be lazy and incompetent, but this took the cake. What idiots, I thought. I wanted to call the DMV and talk to the stupid technician, but I had left my cell phone in the car. I started pacing back and forth through Kinko's, trying to decide whether it would be too risky to ask a clerk to use one of the store's phones, or if I should use the payphone outside. I was to learn much later how very curious a scene this must have been for anyone there who noticed. As I paced back and forth staring at the facts and trying to decide what to do, the DMV investigators were following in my footsteps, keeping close behind me. Every time I turned in the opposite direction, they would swing right back into position behind me as if we were all part of some clown act at the circus. At last, I stepped outside the back entrance and walked over to the payphone. As I picked up the receiver and started dialing, I noticed four suits walking out in my direction. Huh, I thought. I hadn't paid for the fax yet, and now there was going to be trouble over the couple of bucks I owed. All four were looking directly at me. I said, "What do you want?" staring down the woman who was closest to me. "DMV investigators, we want to talk to you." Dropping the payphone handset, I called out, "You know what? I don't want to talk to you," while tossing the fax into the air, calculating that one or more of them would go for it. I was already running through the parking lot. My heart was racing, my adrenaline pumping. I focused all my energy on outrunning my pursuers. Those many hours I'd spent in the gym, day after day, month after month, paid off. The 100 pounds I had shed made all the difference. I ran north through the parking lot, dashed over a narrow wooden footbridge leading into a residential area dotted with palm trees, and kept running as hard as I could, never looking back. I was expecting to hear a helicopter at any minute. I needed to change my appearance, and quick, so if an air unit was dispatched to search for me, I could slow to a walk and blend in with the normal street traffic. When I was far enough ahead to be out of my pursuer's sight, without slowing, I began to shed clothes. Still a gym rat, I was wearing shorts and a gym shirt under my street clothing. I got off my outer shirt and threw it over a hedge as I ran. I ducked down an alley, stepped out of my trousers and dumped them in the bushes in someone's yard, then started running again. I had kept up the pace for 45 minutes until I was sure the DMV agents had given up. Sick to my stomach and feeling as if I might vomit from the exertion, I ducked into a neighborhood bar to rest and catch my breath. I was happy about my narrow escape, but distressed all the same. I found a payphone in the back of the bar and dialed my own cell phone, still in Graham's car. I called over and over and over. No answer. And again. And still no answer. Shit! Why wasn't she picking up? I was afraid she might have gone into Kinko's looking for me, maybe even asked the clerks or other customers if they'd seen me. Damn, I had to get hold of her. Time for a plan B. I called the supermarket and told the person who answered that my elderly grandmother was parked in the handicapped spot right outside the market. I was supposed to meet her, I explained, but I'm stuck in traffic. Could someone please go out and bring her to the phone? I'm worried about her health. I paced back and forth, waiting and waiting. Finally, the man I'd spoken to got back on the phone and said he hadn't been able to find her. Oh, fuck. Had she ventured inside Kinko's? I was going out of my mind, wondering what could be happening. At last I managed to track down my cousin Trudy and tell her what was going on. After yelling at me, she drove to the parking lot and searched up and down the rows until she found Graham's car, not in front of the supermarket, but outside Kinko's. My 66-year-old gray-haired grandmother was still sitting in the driver's seat, waiting for me. The two of them joined me at a nearby Dupar's restaurant, which I had made my way to on foot, feeling sick over Graham's having had to sit in her car for what by now was about 3 hours. When they walked in the door, I was hugely relieved to see that she was okay. "I kept calling you. Why didn't you answer the phone?" I asked.
"I heard it ringing, but I don't know how to use a cell phone," she answered.
Incredible. It had never crossed my mind that a cell phone might be a mystery to her. After about an hour of waiting, she said she had gone into the Kinko's. It was obvious that something was going on, something that looked to her like police activity. One lady was holding a plastic bag with a videotape in it. When I asked what she looked like, Graham described the lady DMV agent who had chased me. In the normal course of my hacking, I never felt guilty about getting information I wasn't supposed to have or talking company employees into giving me highly sensitive, proprietary information. But when I thought about my grandmother, who had done so much for me and cared so much for me all my life, sitting there in her car for so long, waiting and anxious, I was filled with remorse. And the videotape she mentioned? You may never have noticed this, but every Kinko's has security cameras that record a constant video stream onto a videotape loop that can hold something like 24 hours worth of data. That video no doubt contained more than a few clear images of me. Those by themselves wouldn't help the DMV agents attach a name to the person they were now looking for, but something else would. The fax sheets I had thrown into the air were turned over to a crime lab, which succeeded in lifting prints from the papers. Soon enough they had a name. Kevin Mitnick. When agents at the FBI put together a six-pack, a set of six photos, one of me and five of other random guys, DMV Inspector Shirley Lesiak, my pursuer, had no trouble picking me out as the person she had chased. I had outrun Lesiak and her colleagues, but in another sense, I would continue running. I was now on the run, starting my new life as a fugitive.
Part 3. On the Run. 25. Harry Houdini. So I was now on the run, a fugitive. Given what Deputy Marshal Salt had told my mother, that he had a warrant for my arrest, it seemed like the only choice I had. Yet David Schindler, the assistant U.S. attorney assigned to my case, would confide to me years later that he was surprised to learn I had taken off. What could he have been thinking? Eric had told the FBI that I was associating with Lewis, thus violating the terms of my supervised release, and I was sure he must also have reported that I had obtained full access to SAS and had probably been using it to wiretap people. Pac Bell Security had found out I was intercepting the voicemail of at least one of its agents. That was another new charge that could be filed against me. And Lewis had been blabbing and bragging to Eric about other hacking the two of us had been doing. Graham did the driving on the 5-hour haul to Vegas. I hadn't driven at all since finding out that the feds had a warrant out for my arrest. It wasn't exactly a joyful trip. How could it be? Reaching town after dark, she dropped me off at the Budget Harbor Suites, where a friend of ours had kindly booked me a room in his own name. My first task would be to build a new identity for myself, and then disappear, even though it meant leaving behind friends and family, and the life I had been enjoying. My goal was to erase the past and make a fresh start toward a different kind of future. So how do I know how to go about creating a new identity? If you remember my favorite reading material at the survival bookstore where I spent so many days hanging out as a kid, you already know the answer. That book, The Paper Trip, I had soaked up years before, had explained the exact steps for obtaining a new identity. I used the same principles, but approached the task differently. I needed a workable, temporary new persona immediately. Once I had relocated, I could take my time in creating a second, permanent identity that I would live under for the rest of my life. On a pretext call to the Oregon DMV, claiming to be a postal inspector, I asked the clerk to run a search for anyone named Eric Weiss who had been born between 1958 and 1968, a 10-year period bracketing my real birth year, 1963. I was looking for someone roughly my same age, but the younger the better. I would be applying for a new driver's license and social security card, and the older my new birth certificate said I was, the more eyebrows my application would be likely to raise. How could a person in his 30s, say, never have needed a social security number? The DMV lady found a few matches, but only one fit my criteria. The Eric Weiss I chose was born in 1968, making him about 5 years younger than I was. Why Eric Weiss? That was the real name, though a number of sources also spell it Erich Weiss or Erich Weitsch, of the man the world knows better as Harry Houdini. Picking it was a bit of hero worship on my part, a holdover from my early fascination with magic. As long as I was changing my name, why not pay homage to my childhood idol? I called directory assistance and found that my Eric Weiss had a listed number. I called, he answered, and I asked, "Are you the same Eric Weiss who went to PSU?" He said, "No, I graduated from Ellensburg." The Eric Weiss whose identity I would use had a degree in business administration from Central Washington University in the town of Ellensburg. So that was what I would list on my resume. My letter to the Oregon Bureau of Vital Statistics was entirely routine. It purported to come from the real Eric Weiss, listed his real place and date of birth, father's name and mother's maiden name, helpfully provided as usual by Anne at the Social Security Administration, and requested a copy of my birth certificate. I paid extra to have it expedited. For my return address, I used another of those mailbox rental outlets. For the second piece of identification I would need when applying for a driver's license, I planned to dummy up a W-2 form, which would require me to supply the employer identification number, EIN, of the W-2 issuer. It's a simple matter to find that number for almost any company you pick at random. I called accounts receivable at Microsoft and asked for its EIN so we can submit our payment. The lady on the other end of the line gave it to me without even asking what company I was calling from. Every stationery store carries blank tax forms. You just doctor up a phony W-2, and you're all set. My immediate aim was getting that all-important driver's license, but I couldn't move ahead with that until my new birth certificate arrived. It was tense for me during that time. Without a driver's license or an ID card, even being stopped for jaywalking might have been disastrous. One hitch. I would need a car to take my test in. A car I borrowed from my mother or Graham? Hardly. If you're setting up a new identity, you sure don't want to leave a trail of easy-to-follow clues that will make life simple for some snoopy cop or fed later on. Have a friend or family member rent a car for you to use long enough to take the driving test? No way. Too easy for an investigator to find out what car you used for the test and start asking the person who did you that favor some difficult questions. Here's the solution I came up with. First, you go to the DMV and apply for a learner's permit. You don't actually need one, but for some reason the DMV people find it less suspicious for an adult to have one before getting his or her first license. I've never been sure why. But useful for me. Most people trying to obtain fraudulent identities don't go for a learner's permit first, so it's less suspicious. Then you call up a driving school and say you're just back from Australia or South Africa or England. You used to have a U.S. driver's license, you explain, but now that you've been driving on the other side of the road for a while, you need a refresher to make sure you're comfortable back on the right side before you take your driver's test. After a couple of lessons, the instructor will tell you you're ready, and the school will lend you a car to take your test in. This was what I did, anyway, more than once, and it always worked. With my new license in hand, I took myself over to the Social Security office in downtown Las Vegas to get a replacement Social Security card, using my Eric Weiss birth certificate and my driver's license as my two forms of ID. It was a little worrisome. There were signs all over the place about how it was a crime to obtain a Social Security card using a false identity. One poster even showed a man in handcuffs. Great. I presented my credentials and a filled-out application form. It would take about 3 weeks for the car to arrive, I was told, much longer than I felt comfortable staying in Vegas, but I knew I couldn't get a job anywhere without that card. Meanwhile, I trotted around to the nearest branch library, where a librarian was happy to hand me a library card as soon as she finished typing up the info from my application. Though my primary focus was on pulling together my new identity and deciding where I was going to live and work, Danny Yellen, formerly of Teltech but now freelancing, was still feeding me some work. One job was to serve a subpoena on a guy who lived in Vegas but was in hiding. Dan provided me with his last known phone number. I called the number. An elderly lady answered, and I asked if the man was there. She said he wasn't. I told her, "I owe him some money. I can pay half now and half next week, but I'm leaving town, so I need you to call him and find out where he wants to meet me so I can pay him the first half." And I said I'd call back in half an hour. After about 10 minutes, I called the switching control center at Centel, the local phone company. Posing as an internal employee, I had a DMS-100 switch tech do a QCM, query call memory command, on the lady's number. She had made her most recent call about 5 minutes earlier, to a Motel 6 near the airport. I called, and when I was connected to his room, I said I was from the front desk, and did he still need the rollaway bed he had asked about? Of course, he hadn't asked about a rollaway. I said, "Is this room 106? Sounding annoyed, he said, "No, it's 212. I apologized. My grandmother was kind enough to drive me over there. My knock was answered by, "Yeah?" "Housekeeping, do you have a minute?" He opened the door. I said, "Are you Mr. Blank?" "Yeah." I handed him the documents and said, "You are served. Have a nice day." An easy $300. As I signed the proof of service, I smiled to myself and wondered, what would that guy think if he knew he'd just been served a subpoena by a federal fugitive? Once in a while, I'd walk to the Sahara to have a meal in the restaurant where my mom worked so we could see each other. Other times, I'd meet Graham, my mom, and my mom's boyfriend, Steve, at one of the other casinos, where I hoped we could get lost in the crowds. Occasionally, but not too often, I'd show up at a small casino called the Eureka, where mom liked to play video poker after she finished her work shift. Money was an issue. I had some, but not enough. Incredibly, at age 28, I still had most of my bar mitzvah money in U.S. Treasury bonds, which I now cashed in. Between them, my mom and Graham came up with some more to tide me over until I could get settled and find a job. Altogether, my bankroll totaled about $11,000, enough to live on until I could establish my new life. And bankroll was the right word for it. I had the entire amount in cash stashed in a wallet inside a man's carry-on bag that I toted everywhere with me. Since I didn't yet have my Eric Weiss replacement Social Security card, I couldn't open an account at a credit union or a bank. The hotel I had chosen didn't have a room safe like the fancier places. Rent a safety deposit box at a bank? Couldn't do that either. For the same reason I couldn't open an account, I'd have to show some government-issued ID. Of course, stashing the money in my hotel room was out of the question. But how about leaving the wad with Graham? No, because then we'd have to keep meeting every time I ran out of cash. Not a very good plan if the feds started watching her. Still, if I had it to do over, that's just what I would have done. Left it with my grandmother, keeping no more than I needed to get by, but enough that I wouldn't have to go back to the well very often. Right behind the Stardust Casino and Hotel, near where I was living, there was an executive-type gym called the Sporting House. It really was a gym, though in Nevada its name might easily get it mistaken for something else. In fact, the name turned out to be a prophecy. The place is now a strip club, though under a different name. The daughter of Las Vegas hotel tycoon Steve Wynn worked out there, so I figured it must be a cool place. I signed up for weekly passes, determined to continue my regimen of working out for 2 or 3 hours every day. Besides keeping me in shape, the workouts offered great opportunities for girl watching as I jammed to tunes on my Walkman radio. One day I finished my session, went back to the locker room, and discovered that I had forgotten which locker I'd put my stuff in. I walked all around, checking every locker. My personal padlock wasn't on any of them. I walked around again. Nothing. I started opening every locker that didn't have a lock hanging from its metal door. Finally, I found the one that had my clothes inside. my clothes, but not my bag. It wasn't there. I felt my heart sink to my stomach. All my money, all my new identity documents, gone. Stolen. I had bought an extra sturdy padlock to use at the gym. Though a knowledgeable perp would have known a better way, this guy had probably sneaked in with a massive pair of bolt cutters to get past it. Maybe my double heavy-duty padlock itself had been the giveaway that there was something inside that locker worth protecting. Jesus! I freaked out. My entire $11,000 stash had been taken. I was penniless with no income, facing the challenge of traveling to a new city, renting an apartment, and paying my way until I could land a job and start banking a paycheck. I felt like a total idiot for having walked around carrying all my money in a bag, practically asking to be robbed. When I told the on-duty gym manager, I got scant sympathy. She made some lame attempt to make me feel better by telling me that there had been a rash of similar break-ins at the gym recently. Now she was telling me. Then she added insult to injury by offering me 4 complimentary day passes to the gym. Not 4 months, not even 1 month, 4 days. Naturally, I couldn't risk reporting the loss to the police. The worst part was telling my mom and Graham about my unhappy predicament. I couldn't stand the thought of causing them any more anxiety or pain. They had always been there for me, ready to help me out in any circumstances because they loved me so much. That's not to say they didn't let me know often enough when they were upset with me, but they were both able to show anger without withdrawing love. And now, they came through for me again, offering to scrape together another $5,000 between them whenever I was ready for it. I'd say this was definitely a gift I didn't deserve. For diversion, I was going to the movies and sometimes playing blackjack at one of the casinos. I had read Kenny Houston's book on card counting and found I was pretty good at keeping track of the high cards, though I somehow rarely managed to walk away from the table with much more than I had laid out when I first sat down. While I was waiting for my new Social Security card to arrive, I went back to the DMV to report my lost driver's license and got an immediate replacement. In the 3 weeks while I waited for my replacement Social Security card, I acquired as many other forms of identification as I could. By the time I was ready to leave Vegas, in addition to my library card, I also had cards for the Las Vegas Athletic Club, Blockbuster Video, as well as a bank ATM card, and a Nevada health card that food servers and other casino employees had to have. The local Clark County Library became a familiar hangout for me, poring over business and travel magazines in search of the destination I would head for as soon as my new identity was complete. My short list included Austin and Tampa and a few other towns, but the final decision was easy. Not long before, Money Magazine had rated Denver as one of the best places in the country to live. That sounded good. It wasn't too far away. It seemed to have a good job market for computer work. It was well-rated for quality of life, and settling down there would give me my first chance to experience real seasons, something that my life in Southern California had always denied me. Maybe I'd even try a little skiing. I bought pagers for my mother and me, using a phony name for the purchases, of course, and paying cash. I got a third one for Lewis. Yes, Lewis. He would be a good source of information for me. I would be setting up a channel for secret communications, and I trusted him enough, both because of and despite all our history, to feel sure that if he got wind the feds were up to something, he'd sound the alarm. We established a code and a routine to be used in case of emergencies. If my mom needed to get in touch, she would send me a pager message identifying one of the big Vegas hotels. Our code for the Mirage, for example, was 791-7111. The Mirage phone number less the area code. Of course, the area code is the same for all the Vegas hotels, and leaving it off might make the location a tiny bit more difficult to guess for anyone who might be intercepting our pager communications. Another part of the code indicated urgency. 1 meant, at your convenience, please call me. 2 was, call me as soon as possible. And 3 signaled, call me immediately, it's an emergency. When I was the one trying to reach her, I'd just page her with a random number and priority code, and then she'd send back the number for the hotel she was at. Whoever initiated the exchange, the routine was the same. After receiving the number for the casino she was at, I'd call and ask the operator to page someone for me, and would give the name of a friend from Mom's past. It was never the same one twice in a row. I always rotated them. Mary Schultz is one I remember.